This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Keeping track of all the animals in his neighborhood while trying to solve a neighborhood mystery, what he discovers is more than just an appreciation for the natural world. The idea for this book came from Wayne Saunders' own childhood experiences, growing up and exploring the woods and streams and lakes and ponds of his native New Hampshire. The love of nature instilled in his childhood led him to a career as a conservation officer. Wayne Saunders is a retired lieutenant conservation officer from the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department. Lindsay Webb is a naturalist, wildlife biologist, and environmental educator. Together, they collaborated with wildlife artist Ashley Mayers to produce The Cowboy in the Woods, the story of a boy whose love of nature leads him in unexpected directions. Available at wardenswatch.com and Amazon. Warden's Watch Podcast is now on Patreon, combining the Thin Green Line Podcast and the Warden's Watch Podcast on Patreon to bring member-exclusive extra content, both video, audio, and with product deals as well. Become a member to support our podcast and get something extra. Search Warden's Watch Podcast on Patreon.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Brought to you in part by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, International Wildlife Crime Stoppers, and
the North American Game Warden Museum. Welcome to episode 111, and we are going to break out the two guys that you met in the previous podcast, and it's only fair that we start with Ethan Justinger from Utah, since we were sitting on his front porch. And towards the end, you're going to hear some wind noise. Like I said, it was trains, planes, and automobiles, and wind. So everything that wasn't there when we started podcasting, but it gives you that front porch feeling. So, and again, if you guys have an iPhone, if you could go to the Apple podcast there and just bang out a recommendation for Warden's Watch. And I will tell you, if you can tell a friend about Warden's Watch, it's so important. And they can hit that plus sign and help out things right there and follow me. And that helps for the bean counting, so to speak. So enjoy this podcast. As always, I did. And thank you for listening to Warden's Watch podcast. On this Warden's Watch, we're sitting on Ethan Justinger's front porch in Utah. And I'll tell you, for an Easterner, it's just an awesome place to visit. And you got a kind of a cool story, Ethan, because you're an Easterner too.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I kind of just had dreams of being a game warden. So I went to school back. I'm originally from Western New York. Went to school at a SUNY school, just like you did. But it was the College of Environmental Science and Forestry.
So yeah.
My degree's in natural resources management, but I just wanted to be a game warden. So I was firing out applications left and right, just trying to get hooked up with a job to be a game warden. And then I went on an elk hunt in Colorado, and I was like, I need to be in a place that has elk where I can hunt elk every year. So I came out, got hired on with Utah, and here I am 4.5 years later, just enjoying every day.
Cool. Tell me about that hunt. You know, that got you going, that you came out here, because I get to experience that late in life too. And even for an old game warden, it was a pretty epic event, like you said, and I can see myself getting caught up in that. So
sure.
Can you just share a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So I basically was working with a buddy. I worked at a tree service company,
mm-hmm.
and we actually went to the same college, so we knew each other. And then I knew that he liked to hunt and had dreams of killing an elk. And I said, let's do it.
Yeah.
I was like, it's all public land. We can just go in there. We'll backpack in. We'll stay a week. Cause it's like, I've went camping back east. So how hard could it be?
Yeah, exactly.
But when I got altitude sickness. So basically we drove out there the first day and then kind of.
So tags, you got tags and,
yep.
and
yep.
Did you just get cow tags or
nope,
how'd that work?
Yep.
You did.
Archery bull elk archery. Tags we both got.
Okay.
So it was just over the counter, one of the over counter units. We just did some e-scouting, did a bunch of looking through that and picked an area. And we actually got lucky because we picked an area and we're looking at the maps being like, how mm-hmm. hard can it be?
Yeah.
But man, looking at a map compared to looking at the mountain in front of you, it's quite the difference.
Yeah.
But we got lucky because an outfitter was actually using that area. So it wasn't a designated trail like on Onyx, but they had a cut trail.
Nice.
So we went up into that area, set up camp. It was about a 3-mile hike in,
mm-hmm.
Probably 2,000 feet of elevation. So it was a pretty grueling hike going from 700 feet elevation to camping at 11,000 feet elevation.
Yeah.
So, but anyway,
And had you thought about the altitude sickness beforehand?
Nope.
Nope.
Didn't even cross my mind.
Didn't even cross your mind.
Yeah. So, but anyway, the first, we hiked up there, set up camp. We actually bumped a bull on our way in and we're like, all right, we're going to be
in a good spot.
Yeah, we're going to be in the mix. And two whitetail hunters that
mm-hmm.
didn't know, you know, what to expect or anything like that. We had a couple encounters, would hear them bugling just in the first thing in the morning, and then in the afternoon, it was an earlier September hunt.
Yeah, do you remember the first time you heard them bugling?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's just kind of like, man, what a majestic sound coming out of a creature.
It is.
But the thing that is most vividly painted in my mind is one of the mornings, and we were probably camped too close to the elk.
Uh-huh.
So we got out and we would start hunting right from our camp.
Yeah.
I mean, there was nights that we could hear footprints going around our camp and everything like that. So I was like, yeah, we're too close, but we were already there.
Yeah.
Again,
set up.
And I don't want to hike more elevation every morning.
Yeah, for sure.
So, but I had my buddy, his bow actually broke. He went to do a practice shot in the peep sight. came undone. So I was luckily the automatic shooter.
Yeah.
But usually when you hunt elk, you have a caller and then you have a shooter. Mm-hmm. And you, depending on the terrain, you separate those.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't really know that. So he cow called. There was a bull raking on a tree and we got within 50 yards. And he cow called. The bull turned around and came on a line straight to us.
Mm.
And at 20 yards in front of me, it was a cold morning. He bugled and his breath was just rolling off of his mouth. And he had slobber just coming out. Like if you were holding a 5-gallon bucket underneath, I was like, man, this, I am hooked on elk hunting. So yeah, I drew back on him, tried to do that. Tried to have a shot, but man, their eyesight's good enough at 20 yards.
Yeah.
To see that kind of movement. But even after that, I was shaking like crazy.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, we just had a great experience. I mean, we didn't kill an elk, but yeah, enough to leave me wanting more. So yeah, I told about that experience in my hiring panel, and my training lieutenant, who's now my chief,
mm-hmm,
he basically said like, yeah, that's Colorado. That doesn't happen in Utah. And every year since, like, I've had an experience like that. And he's like, yeah, you continue to prove me wrong. And I've got a goal to kill an elk every year that I've been here, whether it's a cow or a bull.
Yeah.
And I've been successful in that. So I've killed 4 elk so far from being out here.
And mostly archery?
So I've only killed one with my bow so far, and that was the limited entry hunt.
Yeah.
But people, when they hunt cows, they usually are looking for cows close to the road or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the first elk that I ever shot was a cow elk 6.5 miles from the trailhead.
Yeah.
So, and everybody thinks that I'm crazy for doing that, but I have friends with horses, so mm-hmm, I was able to pack that out on horseback. But I ate elk for the whole year while they were just saying that I was crazy. So then the next year I killed a bull in that same area. Next year I had an archery limited entry tag that was a surrender permit. So they called me about 2 weeks before the season started. I was like, hey, we have the surrender permit. Are you interested in it? And I only had 2 points, and it usually takes like 8 or 10 points to draw that for mm-hmm, an archery tag. So I knew that it would take me another 10 years to draw it. So still not knowing a ton about elk, but I'm like, yep, this will be a great opportunity. So I took it. I was within 30 yards of 10 bull elk before I killed the one that I did. And it was just a great, like, phenomenal experience. I had friends that came out and helped me. My sergeant let me, I asked him because I had a canvas tent,
mm-hmm,
and he's like, or I asked him to borrow his generator to run a microwave, and he goes, yeah, you can take my generator, but it comes with a camper. So he let me take his whole camper up onto the mountain, borrowed a 4-wheeler and everything like that. So borrowed a lot of equipment to make it work.
Yeah.
But man, it was just very cool. And then, yeah, I just shot a cow elk last year too. And then I get called to ask, or everybody knows that I'm willing to go elk hunting.
Uh-huh.
So they'll like call me up and say, hey, I drew this tag. Are you interested in coming? And I'm like, yep,
yeah,
I am way interested. Cause now it turns into me just wanting to call the elk. Like, I don't care if I shoot them.
Right.
I'd rather have that satisfaction from somebody else,
yeah,
rather than me shoot it. Like, don't get me wrong, I get super excited to shoot mm-hmm, an elk. But to see that experience go through for somebody else and me being the one that called that animal in, that's just going to be, you know, that's what I look for in a hunt. Like, I don't need to be the one that's pulling the trigger or releasing that arrow. I just want to be the part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Got a couple hunts this year. My girlfriend at Nuiya just won that bull elk hunt on the Cooperative Wildlife Management Unit.
Yeah.
And then her brother drew a youth any bull hunt,
mm-hmm,
which is basically a draw. It's 10% draw odds for like the youth that put in, and they go up on those same units that I hunt archery to kill any bull, and they get to hunt with a rifle in the middle of September as well.
Nice.
So I've got some spots lined up there, and then one of our other officers drew a Manti muzzleloader. So where I killed my archery bull, he drew the Manti tag for a muzzleloader. So I've got 3 weeks lined up in September to already go hunting there.
Yeah, you're going to be busy.
And then in December, I've got a buddy with a late season archery tag that he asked for some help with too. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I just love anything to do with elk and love to be involved with any kind of hunt that has to do with them.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear how you got bit by the elk bug.
Man, it's once you... There's people that are like, yeah, mule deer hunting is better. And I'm just like, man, you must not have had an experience like me, because it's hard to beat that.
Yeah.
It's hard to beat a bugle and bull elk in your
face.
Oh,
that majestic sound. You know, the first time I heard it, my hair stood right up on my back, my neck, and I was just like, oh, that's something. That's something you have to experience.
Yeah. It's unlike anything else. Like, there's no way that you can explain it to people.
Yeah. And I think the closer you are, the more impact it is. I was like 35 yards when he let out, and I was just, I mean, the loudness of it at 35 yards, and just, it was crazy. And I could hear all the cows mewing and that were in the herd. It was just,
Feel it right in your bones.
Yeah. To this day, because that was my first experience. So I knew you were going to have your first experience, and thanks for being so descriptive, because I mean, you put me right there with you, with that thing coming 20 yards out of the fog just steaming. That's great. And that's really good stuff to turn into being a game warden.
Sure.
Because your drive is such that, you know, you want to protect those animals as much as you want to hunt them.
Sure.
Because hunters are conservationists. That's, you know, I try to say that as much as I can, because these anti this and anti that, hunters are conservationists. We put our money where our mouth is.
Sure.
And I think that's so important. And as game wardens, when we're hunting, we protect things, and we're never off duty.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely. Yeah. If we're out in the field and we see something, we're going to address it.
We're going to address it, or we're going to say, that's kind of odd that all the deer are going this way.
Sure.
You know, and then you follow it to the end and there's a bait pile there. So, or something to those manners. So I think, you're never off as a game warden. You're always working, whether you're hunting or whether you're patrolling, or whether you're working a case. And it just lends to it when you're out there doing something, because just think of the benefit to Utah of having you hunt. You know, basically, here's the game warden. Not only is he patrolling his normal duty hours, but now he's out there hunting, and he's never off duty. So it just adds to that protection. So Utah, after that experience, I mean, did you test in any other things, or this was the first opportunity that came up, or did you focus?
I had a couple other tests, but the majority, I was so young that I think that the age kind of kept me away, or the Ohio boys that we met at OUIA, they just said that I spelled my name wrong on the application. which might have been, I don't know, but
you don't know that. So how old are you currently?
I am 27.
27. You've been on the job how long?
5 years. So
Five years.
Yep. I got hired at the age of 22.
Yeah. So. That's great.
Yep.
That's, you know, when I came on, 25 was the magic number. They wanted that maturity in an officer. And then 5 years on is that point where you're just getting your feet underneath you, and you're I wouldn't call you seasoned, but you're no longer green. And I think that's the point I always looked at. Officers seem to have come up to their playing field. So they're no longer a rookie. They're the player where they're on the field. And it's that's a great place to be at that 5 year mark, because you got all your skill sets.
Sure. Yeah, but you're still learning. You learn all the time.
You're still learning, but you got skill sets and you're deploying them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're a very competent officer that, you know, especially as a supervisor, you know, that's just great to have a competent officer out there with 5 years on.
Yeah, when I was first interviewing, I was disappointed, and I had a long day at the tree service job. I worked like a 14-hour day.
Mm.
I was like, I did not go to college to chip brush all day. So on a whim, I just sent my application, because I was like, it was like 11 p.m. Sent my application in, and they were the first ones to be like, "Yep, come on out and do this interview." Mm. And then I was like, "Man, I just need somebody to give me a chance.
Yes.
That's all I need. I recognize that I'm young." Mm-hmm. I just need a chance. And they were able to stick their neck out and say, like, yep, this kid is applying everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, within the next year, some other agency is going to pick them up.
Yep.
And I knew that I didn't have experience and stuff like that. So I'm a pretty physically fit individual.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew if there was going to be one spot that I needed to stick out was going to be our physical fitness test.
Right.
So I was like, yep, I'm just going to come here. I'm going to do that physical fitness test, and I'm just going to blow everybody else out of the water, because I need to stand out.
Yeah.
And so, like, there was a forest fire going on. I still remember this. There was a forest fire going on. So all the smoke was blowing into Salt Lake. So I was already fighting the altitude, and then that smoke when you ran. And so you have these other, not scrawny people, but like lighter people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yep, I am going to come in first, because that is how you get noticed.
Yes.
And so I just booked it down the trail and then came back, and I think I finished it in under 9 minutes. You had to run a mile and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I think I finished it in under 9 minutes, and some other person that was from up here, they were like, man, when did you start to get tired? And I was like, the first 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this smoke is horrible.
And right.
The altitude is hard on you. But I knew that that was what was going to make me stand out. And actually talking to my training lieutenant, because I've made a pretty good relationship with him now. Who, like I said, he's my chief now. He personally weighted the physical fitness test, kind of the majority of it, of the hiring process.
Mm-hmm.
In his mind, he was like, if somebody is going out there and is physically fit, that shows their drive and their willingness to be something.
Yeah.
So that's what he told me. He's like, because you stood out there, that's because we had half the lieutenants say, oh, he needs more life experience, and half liked me. And then he kind of just was like, this kid's applying everywhere. He stood out here. He's got high drive. Like, I think we need to give him a chance. And they did. And I think that they're glad that they did. And I am glad that they did for sure too. I love this job. Like, I know it's cliche and you hear it from every other game board, but man, you get to do all the fun things and you don't feel like you're going to work. That's my family back east. They're like, oh yeah, you got paid to go fishing today, or, you know, we do our youth hunts or something like that, and you get paid to do that. It's this is like one of the greatest jobs on earth. No doubt about it.
Yeah, for sure. And when we hear that a lot, but that's very inspiring, or it should be inspiring to people that want this job. You know, because that is a place to stand out. And I've heard from a few game wardens, my brothers in Maine, they're like, hey, it's the only test we give you the answers to.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the physical fitness. So if you can't ace that, then we're going to have a problem.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. And you have time leading up to it,
mm-hmm.
to prepare for it. It's not
right.
like a surprise or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're willing, and if you want that job, you have to just show them that you want it. So pair that with the elk hunting experience. They knew that I was a hunter and have that elk bug, like you said, of like, yeah, he's going to be passionate about protecting that resource as well.
Right. And packing up lock, stock, and barrel, heading out as a new Utah officer across the country from New York, another epic trip. You know, sure. that'll always be in your mind, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That, because I'm like, yeah, I just, you're coming in, you're breaking through, and yep. Yeah.
Yeah, my brother and I, we drove straight through, and so we drove straight through from New York to Utah. It was a 29-hour drive,
mm-hmm.
and I basically just packed everything that I could in my truck and was like, this is what I'm bringing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, driving through Wyoming, it was like a snowstorm. They closed I-80 behind us.
Oh.
So there was tractor trailers all over the road and everything like that. So that was a stressful drive at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And I just started driving like maybe an hour or two. And I looked at my brother and I'm falling asleep while I'm driving. And I'm like, I can't do this. And so we had to switch back again. But then seeing the sunrise, you know, as we're coming into Utah and seeing the Uinta mountain range, and it's just like, this is home. This is going to be a really cool experience. So yeah, I'm grateful that he made that trip out with me, and you know, it was a long haul, but I don't regret it whatsoever.
Yeah. Just it's the start of the adventure.
Sure. And I'm still adventuring every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And you always have that attitude, I think, throughout your career, is the next thing. You look over the next horizon.
Yeah.
We'll be doing this podcast, you know, 20 years from now, and you'll have quite the forte of stories, I'm sure. So, so let's talk about some of your first cases.
Sure.
having the elk bug. You like investigating, I would assume, elk cases even more so than anything else.
Yeah. So just the main, kind of one of the main elk cases that sticks out to me is when I was a newer officer. But you're totally right. Like I definitely work harder on big game cases,
mm-hmm.
Than maybe some other cases. Not to say that I kind of shove them off, but I'm more like, I want to get down to it and figure it out.
And I think that's, you know, everybody would say that same thing. I remember in moose cases, we would do the same thing, put a lot more effort into those things.
Yeah.
You know, deer cases, if they're big bucks or stuff, I think we almost feel obligated to do that.
Sure.
Yeah. So
it's the more attractive case.
Yeah, the jackalope cases, you know, they can go by the, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, yeah, I would say that I was an officer that had about a year on, and it was, I think it was a Sunday night, and I made plans to work with our park ranger, do a side-by-side patrol. Mm-hmm. So we went out on side-by-side, checked some hunting license. It was the archery bull elk hunt. Mm-hmm. So it was the Labor Day weekend, Sunday night. And so I'm all dusty. We finished our side-by-side patrol around, I don't know, 8 or 9 p.m. And I was just pulling into my driveway. And you know as well as I do, that tip call comes in.
Yeah.
So
that tip's turning a poacher.
Yep.
That's what it stands for.
Yep. Exactly. So ours is called the UTIP line. So it's Utah turning a poacher. And I talked to this individual already once because he had an employee that was kind of, he was getting in with the wrong crowd and was talking about going to hunt on private and where he shouldn't be. And this guy just kind of kept his mouth shut and was just listening because he's like, yeah, if they do this, I'm turning them in because it's just not fair to everybody else. Mm-hmm. So I basically got that phone call around 9 p.m. He said, hey, you know, this kid shot a bull elk. He's telling me it's by Bald Knoll, which was on public property, but it butts up to a cooperative wildlife management unit, which is basically a smaller elk hunting unit within a unit. So it's private land that is large enough to be an elk hunting unit. So it's like, I think it needs to be at least 8,000 acres.
Wow.
And so the way that it incentivizes the public to get onto that private is we get to draw some public tags to go on that private. Mm. And in turn, they get, say they get eight elk tags to sell. Mm-hmm. The public gets an opportunity at two of those. So that's not to say that's specific for every CWMU. It's dependent on the property and everything like that.
Right.
But it's a way to facilitate public hunters getting onto private.
Nice.
So with that, I got a call and he said, it's by Bald Knoll. But I think they were talking about going to hunt on the church property, which is part of this cooperative wildlife management unit.
Gotcha.
And so I was like, do you know where it is? He knew who it was. But I was like, do you know his license plate? Do you know what he drives? And he goes, I don't know where on the CWMU they are, but he drives a silver Tacoma. And I was like, okay. And, you know, this was already a 12-hour day. So I was like, are you sure? Like, and he goes, I just have that gut feeling that there is something shady going on. And so I dropped off the side-by-side and was like, I will go to it, my man. So I dropped off the side-by-side. I worked my way up there. And there's two main roads that you can take.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked him, I was like, you know, Lake Creek or Center Creek, which one? And he goes, go up Center Creek. And as soon as he said that, I knew there was a road that kind of winded down and stopped right at that private property.
Mm.
So I was like, man, with any luck, his truck is going to be parked there. Because it takes a while to quarter an elk up and to get it back to the vehicle, right?
Right.
So I knew that I had some time, but I didn't know what time they killed it at. It was probably an hour after dark so far. And it's a bumpy road, so it took me about an hour to get there. But I turn on that road, you know, go past the cattle gate, and then I'm winding down, and I'm just like fingers crossed that I'm turning this corner, and there his truck is. So I turn this corner, and boom, silver Tacoma, like 100 yards away from the private property. So I'm like, I have something here. You are parked too close to this private property. Not to be on it. Yep, exactly. And it was gated and no trespassing. There's CWMU signs and everything like that. So I was pretty confident on it. So anyway, I called for backup because it's probably about 10:30 p.m. I don't know what this is going to be. So I got a pretty good relationship with the county sheriff here.
Yep.
So one of the sergeants came up. And I said, I don't know where they are, but I know where his truck is. So we went up into this reservoir where we could kind of see. And I said, if we can hop up there, we might be able to see headlamps walking around in the trees. So we went up there and we're sitting there. And it gets to be about 1:45 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, hey, man, my shift ended at 12. I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay here any longer, but I'll try to get another officer up here for you. So he coordinates that, and as he's leaving, he encounters a truck that's pulling down. And it's got to be, you know, that other vehicle or something related, because driving around at 2 o'clock in the morning on this mountain road, this dead-end right. road, is like, it's got to be him. So he stops them, talks to them. They got blood on their hands. You know, they're in hunting clothes and everything like that. So he calls me up and basically just asks me, he goes, or he said, you know, did you guys kill an elk? And they admit to it. Mm-hmm. And so by the time that I get up there, I ask him, because I already knew. Like, I knew just the circumstances that this elk was most likely killed on this CWMU. So I just asked him, I said, did you kill that elk on private? And he goes, no, I shot it on public. I go, did you retrieve it on private? And he goes, nope, it was on public as well. So right there, he told me that he knew. He told me that it was on public both times.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, can you take me to that elk carcass? And he kind of looks at his phone, opens up his Onyx, the hunting application,
yep.
all that details.
So it shows the map and
yep,
everything.
Yeah, private and public, which, yep. which that CWMU actually is a different, it has a different layer on it.
Okay.
So it shows National Forest is green, CWMU is kind of like a dotted blue area.
Mm-hmm.
So he opens up his Onyx, and then he's kind of like, well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to take it to, I don't know if I'm going to be able to take you to it. And I'm like, well, if I kill an elk, I drop a pin of where it is, because if you have to make multiple trips, you're going to know where it is.
Right.
And so him just saying that, you know, I was just like, yeah, it's just building that case, you right. know, through a little bit more investigation and everything like that, through some, with the pictures that he had and his in the interview that I had with him on the field, it was determined that it was at least recovered on private property.
Gotcha.
So I told him, I said, hey, like, that elk is illegal. I'm going to be seizing it tonight. So I followed him back to his camp, seized the bull elk with the meat. I did an interview with, there was three individuals total. So I did an interview with the hunter, and then they had another hunter that was back at camp that was sleeping. And so I woke him up, announced myself as a conservation officer, and interviewed him. Well, he kind of alluded to the fact that he knew, he ended up actually shooting this bull four times with his bow and arrow.
Wow.
So that just tells me that he wasn't taking kind of like ethical shots. He was kind of forcing shots in there.
Mm-hmm.
But this other individual had a limited entry tag as well. They put in as a group and they all drew tags.
Oh.
So he was with him with his bow and everything like that. So through the interview, he said the fourth shot was probably on private. And so I kind of got that admission to him. And then, you know, I talked to the hunter again. I said, do you know what you need to do when you find, like, if it goes onto private property? And he told me, yep, I need to get permission. Or I asked him, I said, what if you can't get permission? And he's like, I don't really know. I said, you could call us and we could try to facilitate that, right? Because we don't want animals
right.
just going to waste.
Absolutely.
So I will do whatever I can in my power to try to facilitate somebody to recover their animal.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we leave with that, and then I'm off of the mountain. You know, I meet up with the sheriff's deputy, and we're down at like 5 a.m. So I started my day at 8 a.m. the day before, and I ended it at 5 p.m. or 5 a.m.
Yeah.
So it was 21-hour day. That's my longest day I've had so far, but it came out with a felony-level elk case. So one thing that I forgot to mention, and so this was when I was very new, and obviously mistakes are made when you're brand new, but he had photo evidence of where that animal was taken right on his cell phone. So I probably should have seized that as evidence and then wrote a search warrant later to get that evidence and further gather more evidence, because usually if there's a photo on there, there'll be text messages, anything like that to make your case stronger.
Right.
And I actually,
because that's exigent circumstances,
because yeah,
that
he
evidence can be
it.
Changed up
yep.
or destroyed or
yep,
whatever.
Totally.
So you can, as officers, and I'm doing this more for our listening public, you
sure.
can seize that. And then, and just like Ethan said, then do a search warrant.
Yep.
You know, you have the phone, the exigency now has left.
Sure.
So now we take that extra step to bring it to a judge and say, hey,
yep.
this is why we need to look what's inside this. And
sure.
So.
And then also, I seized his bow because he had a quiver full of bloody arrows.
Oh,
right?
Wow. So
that's evidence that his bow killed that elk, you know, mm-hmm. or further, I could do DNA tests on to match that blood to that elk if needed.
Right. And you know, clothing, yep. shoes, yep. I've heard officers take it all.
Yep, exactly. You know? But he did have a GoPro on the stabilizer of his bow.
Oh, wow.
And in my interview, I basically asked him, I was like, did you film any of the hunt? And he said, no, I was just lost in the moment. GoPro was out of battery and everything like that. And just foolishly, I believed him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he already lied to me so many times. Why right. I believed him on that, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But the next morning, I was like, dang it, I should not have let him take that GoPro off of the bow, because he asked me, he said, can I take this GoPro off the bow before he sees it? And I said, yeah, that's sure, that's fine. And the next morning I was like, he probably has video of that bull getting shot that ties the bow in his hand, you know, to shooting that specific elk.
Yeah.
So anyway, I talked with my investigators and they were like, yep, but you're new like that. And that right. is the way you learn. You make those kind of mistakes. So like we were talking at lunch earlier, there's no way that I will look at a camera mounted device on a weapon. If I'm seizing it, that is going to come with it, because that is part of it. So I definitely learned that as a new officer of like, yep, that needs to come with, because that's going to have evidence on it too.
Right.
So anyway, so fast forward to the next day, I called up our canine handler who's certified in human tracking and wildlife detection, obviously. So I had where he parked his truck and I knew that I wanted to just track his footprints the next morning
right.
and just go right to the elk carcass. So we were able to drive up there the next morning after I booked the evidence that I needed to. We came back up and started the track. His canine's name is Kip. We started the track there. Dog got right onto the track. We were following footprints right into it. And so we dropped into this area and there were probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 wallows that were just absolutely like tore up.
Getting
all
used.
The trees and everything were all tore up. And even in my case report, I kind of explained it because county attorneys don't necessarily know.
Right.
So I explained what a wallow is. So it's a water hole that bull elk will basically urinate in and then roll around in it to get that rut scent to try to attract females. So I put that right in my case because that is a popular tactic for archery hunters to hunt those wallows. So we came down into this wallow and just that elk hunting experience that we talked about, I was just like, this is where this elk was first shot.
Right.
Like I do not have a doubt in my mind, just looking at the circumstances around here, you know, it was an absolute rut fest. So I was like, this is, I said to the other officer, I said, James, this is where this elk was shot first. He's like, yep, totally. I totally agree with it. So anyway, we keep following the tracks and then probably, I don't know, maybe 400 yards from those wallows, we found the bull elk carcass that was covered with sticks and logs. So they tried to conceal the carcass with the sticks and logs. So I'm like, that is not normal for a hunter to take all of the meat and everything like that and then take logs and try to pile them on top to conceal it.
Yeah.
So James and I were like, yep, we have a felony level case here, because that shows their knowingly and intentionally actions to get to that want destruction charge.
Right.
And so in Utah, we have basically the class, anything over $500 is a felony. And so a value of an elk is $750. Now, a trophy elk is considered 6 points on one side. So if it has 6 points on one side, it is worth $8,000 in restitution to the state.
Wow.
And so this was a beautiful 6x6 bull elk, you know, one that anybody would be happy to take, even if you were rifle hunting.
Right.
So I'm sure seizing that from him, like, really hurt him. And he knew that he was in trouble. So we knew that we had a good case, and I kind of talked to my investigators about it, and I was like, man, we need to go get that phone back, and we need to get that GoPro, because that is going to make my case stronger. So anyway, we go back down there, do another knock and talk. We write up the search warrant for there, and we basically show up and be like, hey, man, we have a search warrant for this device and this device. can you provide it? And so he gives us the phone and the GoPro. You know, he's pretty compliant and everything mm-hmm. like that. And so anyway, I do the phone dump on our database that we use. And then I'm just going through text messages and photos, GPS locations and stuff like that right. that come off of the phone. And then luckily the GoPro, he did not delete anything off of the GoPro. Mm. So I was able to look back, and wouldn't you know it, there was like four different clips of him shooting that bull wow. with it. So I had that video evidence, that GoPro connected to that bow, him shooting it. So just building the evidence. But then the interesting thing is, I mean, you learn a lot about somebody when you seize a phone and you go through their you go through their text messages and everything like that.
Opens up their lives.
Yeah, it's he lived a life, that's for sure, full of excitement, but you know, interested in the wildlife related stuff yep. obviously. But what I learned was they were texting before each other, and you know, they were saying, you know, back in August, they were talking about this area, you gotcha. Know, saying, hey, if you turn your maps to topography instead of satellite, it shows the wallows. Or like they were texting when he first shot the bull because he had cell phone service in that area.
Gotcha.
And he said, you know, I just stuck a bull. The other guy that he was with was, you know, he said, you know, Tommy is pissed because apparently he was at full draw on the same bull. So that gathers more evidence that that individual is trespassing as well.
Gotcha.
And hunting in that area too.
Right.
So I have both of them there that are now in the case. So then I basically just gathered more evidence, and the landowner of the CWMU, they were looking to get permission to go on there and hunt. So they called the guide and said, hey, we have these Wasatch limited entry elk tags. Can we go on this property and hunt? And the guide specifically told them, this is a CWMU. Your tag is not valid there. So you cannot hunt here. So that, you know, that is just more evidence that he knew that he could not go on that property.
Right.
But the hunt was coming to an end, and he got desperate.
Mm-hmm.
And then the landowner actually came up to them because they were just camped right on the corner of public and private property. And so the landowner came up, and he or she, can't remember if it was a he or she, they said, hey, you're camped on our property. You guys can't be here. And they pulled up Onyx, and they said, no, based on where we're at right now with Onyx, we are on National Forest, not your CWMU. So that shows to me they know exactly where the boundary is, and they know how to use Onyx, and they have it downloaded onto their phone. So they know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so basically that was just further evidence, right? And then after the fact, right, it's kind of good that I didn't seize my phone, because he had an unknown number in there that he was talking to. And I think he was from Florida or something like that. I never was able to really like track him down, but he told them that the DNR seized the bull elk, right? And then that other individual he's like, well, what did you do? And he's like, I was an idiot and lied, you know, saying that he killed it on public and retrieved it on public. And then that guy responded, he said, you know, well, we keep vials of blood to make blood trails look that way. And I was like, wow, this guy is a serious poacher.
Yeah, for sure.
To create a blood trail to carry it all the way. So I like forwarded his number and his information to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, hey, you like, this is what's going on. This is what I'm finding out with this. So you guys might want to keep an eye out on this guy, because that is what, as a group that we're trying to catch people like that.
Right.
Like if you're intentionally faking a blood trail to make it look like you killed it on the other side of the fence and it ran over there. I've never even thought of that until I looked at that.
I had one case where the guy just set up a kill site in the snow, walked backwards, carried the deer to the spot, and then dragged it out. And it was the extent he went to it when I investigated, it was just amazing. And the only reason I know that happened, because I never charged him, because there was a divorce. So 2 years later, I got a call from a Maine game warden and told me the circumstances that the wife told. And it was beyond the statute of limitations, so it was probably 3 years. But it just burns me.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's great information that you passed along.
But yeah, that's now something that I think of. Mm-hmm. Like if it's on that border, people do that. So, and it's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I had that information and, you know, he said I was an idiot and lied and everything like that. And then, you know, he was texting everybody else about how much trouble he was in. And he's like, I hope they fail to file and, you know, they just kind of forget about it. And I was like, buddy, this is us.
Oh, man.
This is what game warden
you
dreams.
You got the after effect by not seizing it then. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, I was like, these are what game warden dreams are made of. Yeah. A felony bull elk, trophy bull elk case.
Yeah.
So anyway, I basically just kind of finished up that. We did a couple more interviews, but wasn't able to, like, really nail anything down, just kind of gathered some more information, but they were just all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So I just submitted the information that I had, you know, with photos and tried to detail it as best as I could so the attorney would have a good understanding of what actually took place.
Mm.
And those text messages and photos and everything were a huge help in that.
Yeah.
But like I said, I definitely screwed up in the fact of letting him take that evidence when I seized his bow. So that's like one of the main things that I learned from that case. And, but like I said, we're always learning every year. Yeah. We'll learn something new, but I basically wrote up my case report, submitted it to be screened to the county attorney. I met with the county attorney a couple months later and I was like, hey, what's going on with that elk case? And he goes, well, his defense attorney reached out to me and asked what the plea deal was. And my attorney, I basically stressed, I was like, we don't necessarily care about the fine because that goes to the jail or that goes to the county, wherever that goes. It doesn't go to us. I said, just the restitution is what's important to us, is that $8,000 because that goes to getting us equipment, paying for our UTIP line and everything like that.
Right.
So we want to continue that to go because obviously this whole case was made because of that tip of like, hey, something's up here and you should go check it out. I basically went to him and he said that and he said his plea deal was he was keeping it as a felony, which is pretty difficult for wildlife to remain as a felony.
Yeah.
But then they were going to do a 3-year plea and a ban. So he was a convicted felon for 3 years, paid the restitution for $8,000. And then we have an administrative hearing for their hunting rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically if you get convicted of a felony, you get, it's a 7-year suspension of your license. But if it's a trophy animal, it can be doubled.
Right.
So I put him in for 14 years of a suspension and the hearing officer agreed with it and suspended his hunting rights for 14 years.
Wow.
And with the Interstate Wildlife Violator Compact, is it all 50 states yet or no?
It is all 50 states.
Okay, that's great. Because I've been going to Hunter Ed's and I was like, man, I know it's 49, but I couldn't remember if the last state. So yeah, in all 50 states. And that was one of his big things is I have dreams of killing a bull moose in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's suspended for 14 years, then he wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, man, you made that decision
absolutely
to do that.
Right.
And honestly, like, if he wouldn't have lied so much to us, like that's when we kind of are willing to work with people a little bit more.
Absolutely.
But when you're lying to us, it just gets old. We get lied to every day.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, he went through that suspension and then the individual that was with him that was drawn back, I had enough evidence that the county attorney, we have aiding and assisting in violation unlawful.
Right.
So they can be charged with the same thing. However, my county attorney decided that it would be better suited to do unlawful take while trespassing. So it's a Class B misdemeanor. And so he got charged with that and convicted of that Class B misdemeanor for unlawful take while trespassing, which is also revocable offense for hunting. And so this individual actually did something, got charged with the same violation the year prior to hunting in a state park that wasn't open to hunting. And he killed a doe deer on the extended archery, it's called. So he had prior convictions of the same violation. And then since this animal was a trophy animal, his suspension could be doubled. So he went through the suspension process, not super professional. I asked my head investigator, but he showed up like sitting on a white t-shirt. He must have been at work or something. And the only place that he could get into a quiet area was the bathroom. So he's like sitting on his phone on the toilet on the suspension hearing. And I was like, buddy, you are not helping yourself out.
Oh.
Yeah, I was, I, So he actually got suspended for 3 years or mm-hmm. for 6 years as 6 well because it was a trophy.
Yeah.
So even though he didn't even shoot anything, he was at full draw on that same bull elk and got convicted of that unlawful take while trespassing. And so that's the only felony case right now that I've had kind of stick in this county. And so it's something that definitely I am proud of. It's a proud case that I have, but you know, it just goes back to that elk hunting experience. And I care about those animals so much and have such an interest in those elk that I am going to work hard to protect them.
Yeah.
So yeah, if I didn't have that drive for those animals, then I don't know what the case would have been, but I'm just glad that it was. And obviously I learned a lot, and now I pass, you know, there's no shame in admitting that stuff. Like, as making a mistake, even if you have more than 10 years on, be like, yeah, I made a mistake. Tell everybody about it.
Right.
Because then that stops them from making the same mistake. So if you make the same mistake, like I've got another case that I messed up the search warrant, the wording on the search warrant. And basically that got rejected as evidence, and then fruit of the poisonous tree, and then the case kind of falls apart.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, yeah, I am telling you guys this because I don't want you to make that same mistake
I did.
And it's not like my ego is not getting in the way or anything like that, because I want all of our officers to be the best that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no reason in why you should hold back that information.
Right.
And so like that kind of stuff, you know, as this warden watch, I know that a ton of our officers listen to it, and I'm sure it's nationwide the same way.
Yeah.
So just, yeah, make sure that you're talking with other officers and being like, hey, this is what happened on this case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't make this same mistake and your case will be even more solid.
Right. And now you're a field training officer, and that's part of being a field training officer is relaying that information to new hires in that learning skill, you know, taking everything you've learned and put it right back into.
I will say that you do have to, as a FTO, that you have to let them make mistakes because like I said, you're not going to learn by somebody just telling you everything. Mm-hmm. So if they make that mistake and then you're like, hey, what about this? Or, mm-hmm. you know, you didn't see that person drop that pole. You know, if it's something minor like that,
right?
It's not a big deal, but they will remember that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say they go up to a boat and they saw them fishing, and then somebody said like, oh no, I'm not fishing, I'm just nursing my baby or something like that. Gives you some wild excuse. And then you kind of believe it and you forget what you saw already.
Yeah.
But like I guarantee, because that's something that happened with one of our officers. I guarantee you he will not make that same mistake again.
Yeah.
And you know, he'll get photos of people fishing before he's going up and contacting them. And you just learn a lot from making mistakes and going to court. Like, man, when you get up there, the one case that I have is testified for it for 8 hours so far on the stand.
Wow.
And it's just like just getting constantly drilled and mm-hmm. drilled by somebody that makes way more money than you. And you know, you did your best that you could with the experience and the training that you had, and then you walk out of it like, man, I wish I would have done things differently. But whatever, if it comes down to the case getting dismissed or whatever, like I'll catch him again.
Yeah.
He might think that he gets off again here, or, you know, I think with this elk case, I do think that this kid learned.
Like, mm-hmm.
I don't think that he was a bad, I say kid, but he's even older than me. I think that he learned from his mistakes and will be more apt to follow the rules.
Right.
And, you know, cause now he can hunt waterfowl, turkey and stuff like that, but he can't hunt big game until he's almost 50 years old.
Yeah.
So I think that he learned his mistake there and will learn from it. Or at least that's my hope, right? So,
yeah.
And he's not a bad dude. He just made a bad decision and kind of the consequences that followed.
He literally crossed the line.
Yep. He crossed the line.
No, that's really good. Thanks for sharing that story, because that is a really cool elk story.
Yeah.
And given all that we talked about earlier, it applies it.
Sure.
Yeah. Really cool.
Oh, yeah. That is my passion, dude. Definitely. I think about it all the time. You know, I'm running around. My girlfriend gets a little bothered, but I'm bugling on the tube now to practice for September in 2 months, because it's just, you know, people equate it to turkey hunting, but man, there's just nothing like a bugling bull elk.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe if the turkey was, you know, 10 foot tall or something.
Yeah, and it just rattles your bones.
Yeah, so
it's definitely my passion, and I continue to love being out here working with those animals and being able to have the opportunity to chase them every year in September.
Yeah. Well, it's been pretty awesome to experience Utah, hang out with the Utah officers. Like you said, sitting on your front porch, looking that mountain range that here we are towards the end of July, and it's still pretty steady with snow up there.
Yep, exactly. So, yeah, we had a ton of snow, I think, up in... I'm one of the lead snowmobile instructors for the Division of Wildlife, and we were doing an avalanche training with your probes and beacons and stuff like that and shovels. And you'd take your probe out and get it all together, and it's around 9 feet, and you'd be able to stick it all the way into the snow, and then your arm length too, and you still didn't touch bottom. So, I mean, we had over, 10 feet of snow up there in the mountains, which is great, and then it's a good year. It was a tough winter for the animals that didn't survive, but the animals that did make it, I was talking to my biologist, and they said it's kind of like surgery. You know, you're gonna hurt for... the first couple months or years in this instance, but the strongest animals that made it through that are going to be your breeding population.
Gotcha.
So in the next 5 years, those animals are going to be the ones that are breeding. So you're going to have the healthiest deer and elk, moose, and everything like that. And then just with the water that we've had this year, the antler potential for the animals that you are able to harvest this year is going to be off the charts. So it's going to be a pretty exciting year in Utah to have those tags. And I'm just excited for it, and definitely feel blessed that I get that opportunity to chase those critters.
Yeah. From New York to Utah, and it doesn't sound like you're ever going
to
leave.
And it's hard to, just like you said, the past week that you had, we went out fishing yesterday, and you guys, I know I see you constantly taking photos, and being like, this is so cool. And I'm like,
that's to make everybody back east jealous.
This is my patrol district. And Chris mentioned it the other day, but he goes, as we're driving down and you can see all the mountains around and just the beautiful scenery. And he goes, does this ever get old? And I say, I do get used to it until somebody new comes.
Yeah.
And they're just like, man, look at this place. Like my sister, I took her up for a side-by-side ride last year, and we just went up on the mountains. There's a reservoir called Tibble Fork Reservoir, and it's cliffy, and it's beautiful, gorgeous trees everywhere, and water and everything like that. And, she just, almost every day, she's like, I can't believe you live here.
Yeah.
So it definitely makes me feel definitely fortunate. I've got a pretty supportive family. That's everybody that asks me, that's the only thing that I miss from back home is my friends and family. I have a super flexible schedule and a super understanding supervisor where he's like, if you need time to go take care of that stuff, or if they're coming out to visit, you take that time off and, spend time with family, because you can't get too lost in the job. I know that you talked about, we're always working and stuff like that, but man, sometimes you just need to decompress and go spend time hiking out with your sister, my sister, or, having my family. They came down to Moab a couple of years ago, and we rented side-by-sides, and we don't have street legal side-by-sides in New York, but down in Moab, you're just ripping around everywhere.
Going everywhere.
And, my dad is just like, he was just blown away, and it was like seeing like he was like a kid again, just driving that. My mom's screaming, and then she'll kill me because I know that she's going to listen to this, but she's screaming in the back seat because, the first thing they tell you not to do is kind of drift the machines.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty hard on equipment, so, what did I do the first sand dune? I just wheeled it right around there, and, she's yelling. My dad's laughing, feeling like a kid again, so... It's just a riot, and the diversity what the state has to offer, from those red rocks to the alpine, it's just unreal. It's a crazy, crazy place. And from somebody back east, I would, just highly recommend coming out here and spending a week or two and having an elk experience like that, or just seeing what you can see out there. It's just the scenery is its own, just the scenery is something to look at of in amazement.
Yeah, so 100%. Every time I come west, I appreciate it.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful place for sure.
Yeah,
and you get to live it.
Sure. So. Yep, and I'm definitely fortunate enough to live that.
Yeah.
So
and probably inspiring the next generation of game warden to move west to with this podcast.
Yeah, hopefully it's an expensive cost of living out here, but yeah. if you're willing to make it work, I mean, I don't think there's a better place than to be a game warden out west. I mean, that's the dream, right? Like, I think that it is just paramount compared to everywhere else. Cause that's what people ask me if I'm going to go back to New York and do that or go back east closer to home. And, you know, like I said, I have a flexible schedule, so I think that I'm going to be able to make things work and make more time for my family and go back. Yeah, I have that desire to do fish and wildlife stuff. And I think when you go back to New York or other eastern states, you kind of get roped into that environmental quality aspect, which is important, you know, but I don't have that, you know, I don't have that as big of an interest in that as I do, you know, say elk or deer cases or bear cases, mountain lion cases, stuff like that. Like I want to focus strictly on the wildlife aspect of it.
Very cool. Thanks for sitting down on your front porch, Ethan.
Yeah.
And, talking to me.
No problem.
All kinds of sounds of things going on around.
Sorry, but, the house is
that's
still
part
under,
of it.
Yeah, the house is still under construction. There's construction going on, but now I feel fortunate enough to get into housing here. So
yeah,
happy to have you.
Congratulations. So. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Wayne.